left my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the rowdy road, many kinds I met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm on.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. Unspun brings you information you need and asks the questions that need to be asked. We are streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the listen button. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. And anywhere that you can hear me, you can also call in. So don't be shy. It doesn't matter where you live. Of course, you might have a slight phone bill there to pay, but you're welcome to call from wherever you're hearing us. Today, our guest is Janessa Gans Wilder, a former CIA analyst and now world peace advocate with the Euphrates Institute. She founded Euphrates on the heels of a 21-month assignment in Iraq. Janessa was liaising with top Iraqi leaders in the run-up to the first elections in 2005 and witnessed firsthand the clashes between Americans and Iraqis and the lack of cultural, religious, and historical understanding that pervaded both sides. Convinced that our foreign policy challenges require more than a government effort, Janessa resigned from the CIA to start a grassroots movement to allay fear and restore trust between the West and the Middle East in the aftermath of 9/11. Her aim is to help citizens on both sides realize their mutual humanity as a way to find lasting freedom and security. Her Middle East experience has included Arabic study in the Palestinian territories and extended travel throughout the Arab world. After 5 years of government service in the Middle East and South Asia, she became a consultant to the State Department and a visiting professor of Middle East issues at Principia College. Janessa received a master's degree in international policy studies from Stanford University and her BA from Principia College. She says, "I've experienced the impact of healing the divide between Middle East and West through the power of personal relationships. I'm so grateful to be a part of a community that understands how timely, imperative, and indeed possible is change in our relations with the Middle East, and that the best way to accomplish this is to begin with ourselves and our perceptions." Janessa, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Thank you, Doug. It's great to be here.
Well, and I want to welcome you back home. I know you're back in Reading now, too, so welcome home.
After 20 years, and I'm so grateful to be back. It's just such an incredible community.
Yeah, and you have family here that loves you to pieces, so and
family,
other people.
And the mountains, and no traffic, and clean air, and there's just really... And I think there's an increasing dynamism in the community. People are really wanting to reinvigorate things in downtown and activities and the arts. And I think it's just a great time to be in Reading. There's a lot of growth and inspiration happening.
Well, we have a lot on the upside.
Yeah.
We have a lot we can do here at the community level. I agree with you there. What I find interesting about your life is, of course, your earlier time in the green zone, your time with the CIA. And I thought maybe our listeners would like a quick history of your life. I mean, not early life, but maybe your involvement with the CIA and in the Green Zone, and at such a critical time. It was such a critical time in our history. And so maybe you could give us a little history of your past and your evolution to how you've gotten to where you're at now.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, the reason I joined the CIA to begin with is I did a lot of traveling growing up, and I just loved learning languages, cultures. There was just so much. I just felt that there was a lot out there in the world, and I thought, oh my goodness, here's an institution that is learning the most about what's happening abroad. You know, they're on the ground. They're being enmeshed and immersed in that perspective and that culture, and then helping, using that information to inform our policymakers. And I wanted our policymakers to have the best intelligence possible to make the best decisions. And so that was really my motivation at the beginning to join the agency. And, you know, truth be told, the first 2 years I was stuck in a cubicle in Langley and couldn't, you know, to me, it's hard to be considered an expert when you're not on the ground. But as analysts, so much of that work is just done from a computer, from a desk, you know, writing papers and giving briefings. And so I was really grateful, actually, for the opportunity after 9/11 to go to the field. And that was heading out to Iraq. And it was just a 90-day stint. And I kept extending it until I was there for 21 months. Because being on the ground was just a completely different experience. And you're finally, you know, I'm finally there meeting the people and smelling the air and eating the food and as much as we could from the Green Zone. But you're just on the ground and there's a totally different feeling. So the first year I was there as an insurgency analyst, and there were, you know, a team of just a few of us, and we'd sort of split up the country as to what areas we would be analyzing and being experts in. And so my area was Al-Anbar province, which was the Sunni triangle there. And that includes such garden spots as Ramadi and Fallujah and all the really hot spots at that time. So the climax or the culmination of that experience was probably, I spent almost 2 weeks in Fallujah during the first mini battle there at the base outside the city. And that was in April 2004, right after the four Blackwater guards had been strung up by the bridge, you know, by Iraqis in Fallujah. And then we responded with force, you know, taking over the town, or at least trying to, with the Marines. So that was just a pivotal moment, because it was being in as close to conflict and the combat zone as I'd ever experienced. And there were, you know, mortars flying all over the place and counter battery. And we had to go everywhere with our flak jackets and weapons. And so it's just a real feeling of hopelessness and confusion and despair at seeing the Marines return from the front wounded, and feeling like I just so wanted to help the situation. You know, what could I do? You know, my job was really to help the military understand the dynamics of Fallujah and who was working for us, who was working against us, who were the friendly imams, what were the areas in town that were better to be in, just helping them get more situational awareness in Fallujah. And it's just that feeling of being of not having a complete picture, of not knowing how to move forward, of feeling like this conflict could just spiral out of control. And I really felt the sense of hopelessness that really hit me at a deep level. And a little while later, I was down in Ramadi, so a different part of Al-Anbar province, sitting alongside the Euphrates River. And I'd just gone out to get some peace and quiet one morning. I was staying on a special forces base, sort of still decompressing from the war zone. And it was so quiet and so still and so beautiful. And I was just sitting there that morning thinking, just letting that sense of peace and quiet pervade my senses, which had just been totally overwhelmed by the war zone. And I just realized that that river was just flowing just a few miles away, right in the middle of Fallujah, which had been the scene of that war zone. And I thought how different those two pictures were, the incredible chaos and darkness of the war zone versus this beautiful, peaceful picture of this river, and that they were had been happening in the same space. And the thought came to me, which one will you choose? Because they're both happening in the same area, and I felt in that moment that I needed to choose the river. And to me, it symbolized hope and life, and that there's light even in the middle of the darkest situation. There was peace and stillness, and I could choose that. And honestly, it was just, you know, a huge revelation for me at that moment. And I went back to Baghdad and told my boss I wanted to stop just being focused on the enemy and stop taking out bad guys and destroying things. And I wanted to be part of building up. But could I do something on the political side? And he walked me down to the Coalition Provisional Authority there, and I became the liaison to political parties in advance of the first democratic elections. And instead of interrogating Iraqis, I was all of a sudden sitting on the same side with them, looking at this opportunity for elections and talking about democracy. And it was a complete shift. It was a complete transformation in my experience after that moment of clarity. And then I wanted to really bring that sense of how transformation happens and how we can be more effective political agents in the world, or just more effective at advancing not only our interests, but the shared interests that we have with others. Because the Middle East so directly impacts and affects us, we need to operate on the basis of shared interests and advancing good rather than just destroying, you know, taking out things, which to me always felt like holding a glass of water beneath a leaky faucet. You know, great, you catch the drops, but you're not fixing the faucet, and you could do that till the cows come home. So I wanted to share that with others, and that was the primary motivation for starting the Euphrates Institute.
Yeah,
that was a very long answer, but
no, that's a great answer, and that's kind of where I wanted to go, because I just think that epiphany that you had sitting there on the Euphrates River is very important, because we look at the situation now, and I know you still write about the Middle East situation,
mm-hmm.
and we have ISIS, and so all those efforts and all those lives basically. That whole effort was misdirected in my mind. Of course, I was anti-war from the beginning, before the invasion, actually, because I saw that it was illegal and immoral and driven by the wrong reasons. And so from my perspective, was always doomed. And then we had, because it really wasn't something that was, and you point this out, that we were going to solve militarily, and
mm-hmm.
And we made so many mistakes, and you were there to witness so many of them, the dismissal of the Iraqi army, the de-Ba'athification, as they called it at the time, basically alienating all those people that are now invested in ISIS in the same region, and the same region where you worked. Just so backwards, the whole idea of invading and occupying another nation through military force illegally, it was, in my mind, always bound to fail. So, and sounds like you came to the same conclusion. So what is, your analogy is catching drops, Ray McGovern, another CIA analyst that I know, they call it drying up the swamp. So how do we go about, with all these investments in military might and arms floating around the Middle East, what are the chances of ever creating peace there?
Yeah, you know, I also want to go back to what you just talked about, invading another country and taking over. And actually, I think the motives were not ill-placed. You know, this idea of the neocons, of having a democracy in the Middle East. You know, there is research that points out that democracies don't fight each other. And so to have this beacon of democracy in the middle of the Middle East, how that might inspire the region, it could be a strong ally for us, it would be a benefit to its people. So the motivations and the idealism were, you know, to me, very laudable. And I actually think at our core, as a human being everywhere, we all yearn for freedom. We all yearn for democracy, to have our voice heard. It's just how that system looks in that culture. You know, it might have different attributes than just the Constitution and elections. And, you know, we have this sort of cookie-cut model, but democracy might look very different in another culture. And then what I learned is that you can't shock a system and have democracy instantly take root. You know, we essentially went over there. I've had a Shia cleric tell me this once, that Saddam was this radiator cap that kept this traumatized, deeply scarred society together. And we came over and we took off the radiator cap and the contents exploded. And so really, our decapitation of the regime and the debathification and the disbanding the army, it was just this shock to the system. And you can't expect a transformation of people's hearts and minds and a whole society from dictatorship mentality to a democracy mentality to happen overnight, and not through the way we did it. You know, maybe if you're working slowly at the grassroots through education and cultural programs and women's rights and, you know, arts, and there's so much that goes into the democracy as a mindset, respecting each other, appreciating the other, listening, all those deep skills. And somehow, as Americans, I don't think we understand that process yet. We still think in terms of quick military strikes and quick military victories and get in and get out. That does not accomplish transformation. And so that's, you know, what's fascinating to me is learning more and more about it's the process of transformation. If we want better relations with the Middle East, if we want an end to terrorism, if we want fewer wars, what does it look like to for a society and a people to transform? And we're not the ones to do that, but we can support the ones in those cultures, in those societies who are doing the work of transformation. That's what we're doing as Euphrates Institute. You know, it's not my place to go over and I'm going to make peace between the Israelis and Palestinians and you just need to forgive each other and move on. And, you know, or I'm going to transform Iraq. Even with the best intentions, I realized my last year in Iraq that it's not my role to do that, and I'm not capable of doing that. But it has to come from within, you know, the Iraqis themselves, the Israelis and Palestinians themselves. But we can be good stewards. We can be supporting the visionaries and transformation agents and peace builders in those societies. And instead, we turn a blind eye to them. We ignore them. We give them no support. We give them no funding. They're on their own. And it just baffles me.
Let me step in at this moment and just remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. With us today is Janessa Ganz-Wilder, ex-CIA analyst in the Green Zone in Iraq and currently founder of the Euphrates Institute, working for world peace. We're discussing her life and work in the world, and our number here in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. We invite your questions and your comments. And in fact, we enjoy them, so don't be hesitant to call if you'd like to call in and ask Janessa some questions about the Middle East. She is a Middle East policy expert, more or less, and she writes about it at Euphrates.org. So call in 337-1885. And what you point out, obviously, is part of the problem when we're putting millions of dollars an hour, literally, into military adventures, and we expand these adventures throughout the Middle East, disrupting more and more of civil society and putting in place sectarian leaders. It's so predictable. that it's going to fail. So are our military and political leaders, I can't believe they're stupid. So it seems to me they're good at one thing, creating chaos, and then walking away, but not entirely walking away. We maintain air power over everybody, but it's such a recipe for failure. And I can appreciate what you're saying. I know peace activists that sat. I had Kathy Kelly on with us, and she actually sat in Baghdad during what we called shock and awe, and sat with the people in Baghdad in their homes, making a statement, willing to die to make a statement. And so I honor those people, but I can't be an apologist for our government. And because I think if we can't look honestly at who we are, and I'm not talking about individuals, collectively who we are in the world, then we're never going to solve this problem. And that's just my thoughts on your response there.
Well, just to add to that, Doug, I actually don't. All the military experts, political leaders, to me, they completely get it that there is no military solution. You know, even my recent article on ISIS, to a person, they acknowledge the limitations of firepower and even the very definition of counterinsurgency, the COIN doctrine. It cannot be a military solution. It is winning hearts and minds. So to me, it's not our government. We have to turn the finger back at ourselves. They get it. They do not think that the American public and political and culture and strategic culture has the patience for longer term responses, has the appetite, has the commitment and the investment that requires. They would love to be able to think and plan and do those things. They don't think that there is the political will of the people. So to me, it's how, even in the grassroots in our country, how do we educate Americans that what is needed is not these, you know, drone strikes, but you do need a full-fledged response, or you need this or that. And that will help give the political will and the support that our leaders, both military and political, need to be able to make changes on the foreign policy level. So even in the U.S., it comes back to that slow, gradual change in our hearts and minds about what it looks like to be a force for good in the world.
But we know also that there was great resistance by the public and around the world to the invasion of Iraq. We also know that Barack Obama was elected to unwind all of that stuff, but here we are. So I don't think we can put it back on the people. A great number, in fact, the majority of the people are against these things, and yet our government moves forward, and with all the, well, look at the investment in the Pentagon. The Pentagon has the largest single chunk, over 50% of our discretionary budget in the U.S. We've gone trillions of dollars into debt to support this military insanity, and so I don't think we can put it back on the people. I think the people have been ready for peace for a long time, but the people with influence don't want it because maybe they'll lose some value in their stocks, or maybe their dividends won't be so high. There's people with money at the top that really, in my view, are the influence. And I know you've met some of these people, you worked with some of them, to say I don't think they're interested in democracy building. I think they're interested in the same thing America's been interested in since the Second World War, and that's total domination of the world. And we know this because this has been the primary – if you could analyze everything and use that as your primary assumption, and it all makes sense.
Yeah, I have to disagree, Doug. I think it's a convenient way to look at things and putting the responsibility on them, but having it, knowing these people and having been at that level and the motivations to want to advance, you know, American interests, American goodwill in the world, and not feeling the support for that. I think, you know, even if there are those who want to rule militarily, and, you know, even if there are those, I think it still comes back to, we can't control, you know, look, we even put in someone like Obama, and even he had difficulties wholesale changing foreign policy and changing the way we operate. And so I think we have to go turn back to what can we control? And that's each one of us having, you know, again, living this sense of transformation, getting to know others, understanding more about the region, and then impressing upon our leaders through our expression of democracy and public opinion what we want our foreign policy to look like and what values we want to have it expressed. And so I think as much as possible, we have to redirect the attention on what each one of us is doing and not just, oh, you know what, they'll fix these problems. They're the government. They have the power. They have the money, because they're not that smart. And they don't, you know, these are global problems that we're dealing with today, which require global solutions. They really do require every single one of us to be a part of it, because no government, no matter how effective or strong or wealthy, can fix this. They can't fix climate change. They can't fix terrorism. They, you know, these are huge issues that we're dealing with that I think require everyone to step up and do our part. And I think we give the government too much credit. Or not enough sometimes.
Yeah. Well, certainly the government is, by most accounts, dysfunctional in the U.S., and I think the very things that you bring up, the inability to bring about some sort of stability in the world, the inability to direct money out of a military budget into something that would help solve the problems of climate change while we still have time, all of these are a reflection of the failure of our government. And we can blame it on the people. Most people, I would think, really would rather have the relationships that you're talking about. They would rather be at peace and be able to travel the world securely and be able to enjoy other cultures. I think most people, given those choices, would want that. And yet, and I guess we're just going to have to agree to disagree, but and yet, I don't think it matters. Almost every poll that's ever been taken shows what the people want. Almost every election, national election at the federal level shows that what people want. But that's not what happens. And you talk about Barack Obama and the abilities. Let's take Guantanamo for an example. He could have closed that day down the first week he was in office, but here we are. It's still open. Maybe you know the answer to how many innocent people are still there. Almost all of them were innocent, 80 to 90%, but they were taken there, abused now for over a dozen years. If we want to dry up the swamp, if we want to fix that faucet, those are the kind of things we can do in an executive order. They were created with an executive order. They can be taken down with an executive order. The same thing with other things in our government. So why doesn't Barack Obama do this? Why are we here? ISIS, you talk about recruiting tools. Well, Guantanamo is the perfect one, and so easy to solve, and yet we can't seem to solve it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good example. That's a good point. Yeah, where to keep terrorists and how to try them and or not try them is been so sticky, I think, for Democrats and Republicans alike. Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know from their attorneys, which now have had a little bit of a chance to speak out, even all of these things are controlled. That's another problem that we're having, and maybe we can talk about the media a little bit more with you. But the media is not giving people the information that they need to make intelligent decisions. It's focused on something else. Usually we get distracted and the world goes on. It's almost the bottom of the hour. Let me take this moment here to make a couple of announcements. We have a couple of community events, And I also want to do a little station ID, and you're listening to Unspun on KKRN 88.5 FM in Bella Vista. KKRN is a community radio station funded by listeners and underwriters like yourself. If you would wish to support our efforts, go to our website at kkrn.org and click on the donation button. That is truly what keeps us on the air. We are almost totally donor-supported and kind underwriters in the community that keep us on the air. So thank you, all our underwriters and donors. By the way, we don't stop often enough to thank the people that are keeping us on the air and providing the funding needed to keep the radio station going. Well, I have two interesting community events. We have our very own Wicked Fell Theater Players are celebrating Darwin Day with a presentation entitled Chase Darwin Gunslinger. They'll be live in the community room at the Reading Library, 2:30 p.m. That's tomorrow, February 7th. Yes, they know it's Super Bowl Sunday, but they're just going to go right in the face of that. So if you'd like to go, it's a KKRN fundraiser, and they are asking for donations at the door, but I don't think anybody would be turned away. Also, we have the Reading Climate Coalition. It's new here in the community. Is co-sponsoring with the First United Methodist Church and the KKRN Community Radio. And we're having a screening of the documentary This Changes Everything by Naomi Klein and acclaimed filmmaker Avi Lewis. And that will be February 16th, 6:30 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church at 1825 East Street in Reading. And if you want more information about that, you can call 530-243-2403, or you can go to the Reading First United Methodist Church's website. It's at readingumc.org. You're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling, and let's get back to our guests. With us today, Janessa Gans-Wilder, ex-CIA analyst in the Green Zone in Iraq and currently founder of the Euphrates Institute working for world peace. And we're discussing her life and her work in the world. And if you'd like to call in, you can call in 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Well, Janessa, I'd like to – I don't want to spend the whole hour talking about Iraq and the Middle East. I'd like to talk about what the Euphrates Institute is doing and look a little bit more on the positive side of what you've been doing with your life since you've come back home and started the Euphrates organization.
Sure. Well, it's interesting you bring up the media, because I agree that the media does – provide such an incomplete picture. You know, we get snippets and headlines and a few paragraphs, and it's so difficult to understand the context, the history. You know, let's say the article's about the bombing of a Sunni mosque, you know, by Shia or vice versa, and we don't understand the roots of the Sunni-Shia conflict and the history of that country. And so one of the focal points of Euphrates is I lead trips to the region. And right now the trips go to Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. I would love one day to put a Syria trip on the books. You know, I studied Arabic in Syria, just an amazing country. Go to Lebanon, the Gulf, and Iraq, and I'd love to do a northern Iraq and Turkey. And anyway, I have all these ideas. So as my young family grows and as the stability, a bit more stability comes to the region, we'll be doing more. But these trips to Israel, Palestine, and Jordan that we do are so critical in providing people context. You know, we meet with over two dozen groups in 2 weeks, from extremist settlers on the Israeli side to extremist Palestinian militants on the other side. And you really get an understanding of why this conflict is continuing and what's driving it and what's the mindset that's driving it. And then we meet with the people who have worked through that mindset and have adopted the mindset of peace and forgiveness and interdependence and oneness even. And it's just phenomenal. You see this myriad of perspectives and you think, okay, there's no way this is ever going to move forward. And then you meet those very people who are in the midst of that and who perceive a totally different way of doing things. And so one of the the mantras, you know, that we work with on the trip is Albert Einstein's quote that, or idea that problems cannot be solved at the same level of thinking that created them. So we really look at what is the level of thinking that creates conflict, you know, fear, reactivity, zero sum understanding of things, you know, winner take all. This is my land. It can't be your land too. It's only mine. And anyway, just really understanding what's that mindset, and then investigating and exploring the mindset that sees the possibility of mutuality and solutions and forgiveness and sharing and cooperation. So it's so fascinating to see both of those and explore the whole, you know, the whole perspective. And so you come away with, you've been there, you've met with people on both sides, you just have such a fuller understanding, and then also inspiration. And our mission at Euphrates is to inform, inspire, and transform. So to me, that first key piece is being informed, you know, truly understanding what the issue is or why this part of the world impacts us so directly. And so what's going on there and the complexity of these issues that we just get barely hints of in our media. But we can't just be informed. We need the inspirational piece. So how do we move forward? What are solutions? How does this get solved? And so that's where we meet with these peace builders and these change agents. And then finally, transform. What does it look like to help the transformation process on that side? But then we have to start with ourselves. So it's really easy to say, oh, the Israelis and Palestinians should forget the past and move on and forgive each other. But, you know, have you really forgiven your neighbor for what they did, or your brother for a slight? Or, you know, it just, you can't just talk the talk, you have to walk the walk. And so what does it look like to really look at transformation in your own life, in your own, you know, inside, in your personal relationships, in your own community? So the other part about Euphrates is then when people come back, they can join or start chapters. We now have 15 chapters all throughout the world. We just started this a year ago, and it's just taken off, which is so thrilling. We have a local chapter here in Reading. And we have chapters across the country, and we have one in Hebron, Palestine, in India that a Muslim and a Hindu started together, in Colombia, in Europe. And it's just so exciting to see what people in each community are wanting to tackle. You know, who is the other in their community? What needs peace brought out in their community? How do they become more informed about the Middle East and our connection to it and the impact it has? What are Middle East issues that they want to learn more about? So the local chapter here in Reading is very active. We just had our meeting Tuesday night, about 15 people and from, you know, all sectors, and they're planning lots of events and reading books together and visiting the local mosque in a couple weeks and the local synagogue, and just trying to understand, even here in Reading, how to become more informed, inspired, and transform things in the community that need healing and conflict resolution, and then also being agents of global change. So those are two of the programs we do.
Well, that's a large undertaking. and I think admirable, because I don't think any evolution doesn't start somewhere else. It starts in your own mind and in your own heart. So to work for those things, all that is part of a wonderful vision that you have. And I've worked on those things on myself for many, many, many years, but I understand that it's not an easy thing. It's because you have to start questioning yourself, questioning your identity, your belief system, your worldview. So it's a huge undertaking, and I'm glad you're doing it. I'm glad somebody's doing it. I know that. Well, you would fall in line with a lot of religious leaders around the world, of course, you know, the Dalai Lama and now the Pope. He's becoming pretty outspoken. And we're all saying the same thing. Of course, the world is not a bunch of lines on a map. The world is one thing. And to recognize that is certainly a first step, because that gets you out of your own, what I call kind of your collective identity, and possibly make you capable of seeing what I call the shadow. And I hope that you're very successful. I tend to be the cynic, though, and I can see that you tend to be much more optimistic. And so how do you maintain that optimism? Because you're going head-to-head with all kinds of power players and money at a much higher level.
You know, it just stems back to, I'm very practical. I just want to know how to make a difference. I know that as a world, we need to see change right now. There are massive, massive issues and problems that are affecting every one of us and getting worse by the day. And so I'm really driven by what can you do about it? What can we do? And so to have perceived the inability at the top level, you know, even with our military might and the entire force of America, to not be able to transform Iraq, you know, take care of the terrorism problem and transform it into a democracy, really shows the limitations of traditional means of power. And so I just kept digging deeper, and I still am trying to understand, what can we truly affect and influence? And this is where I've come down to realization that it has to start at a personal level. And I'm not optimistic, and it's not hard to be optimistic, because that's where I do see change. I see fundamental, transformational effects, and that is so encouraging. And that's what encourages me it's like teachers, you know, they feel such a sense of reward if they've affected one student. You know, well, that one teacher is affecting that one student can actually point to a lot more tangible change than someone at the top who's trying to reform policy, you know, education policy. They don't actually know if they've had that effective transformation. So it's just such a practical thing. And also another study that gives me confidence that this is the model, that this is the only model for true change, and then I'm on the right track here, and that I wasn't totally idiotic to leave government service, which so many people have told me, why would you leave? But it's this model out of Stanford Research Institute by Everett Rogers. And he wrote many, many books all along this idea of the diffusion of innovation. Basically, long story short, he says that once he did all these studies of how social change happened, from the introduction of new corn in Iowa to, you know, social experiments, and he always found the same curve. And he said that once 5% of a population accepts the new idea, that's considered embedded. So the seeds are planted. And once it reaches somewhere between 5% and 20%, so it's that threshold tipping point somewhere in between there, that it's unstoppable. So the change just takes off. It hits that curve, you know, and skyrockets. And so those 5%ers he calls visionaries and early adopters, you know, they see the import of this new idea or this new vision. They get it. And the idea has to reach 50% of the population in order to grab the attention or the awareness of those 5% who actually get what you're talking about. And then they work tirelessly to get you to the 20%. And then you always have those late adopters. They're at the very end of the bell curve, and they're just holding on for dear might to resist the change. And so I think, you know, it shows us where our energy is best spent. You want to work with people who are like-minded, who see, you know, for example, in the Israeli-Palestinian situation, those people who see the vision of coexistence and peace and solutions, and who are already living that and trying to bring that into their community, you know, the more that you strengthen and embolden them and amplify their voices and support them, they're your 5%. You want to help them reach the 20%, and then you have the tipping point of change. And we're not, our time is not best spent with those late adopters, you know, the people at the top who have vested interests, you know, or let's say even in our government, those who have vested interests in the status quo and who are going to hold out to resist any type of change. So I love, it also shows that you don't need to convince the majority of people, you know, let's say that peace is the answer or whatever. You really only need to convince 1 in 20, you know, or 1 in 5, or 1 in 10, somewhere in there. It's a small number of people who can constitute mighty change. You know, was it Margaret Mead who said, never doubt the power of a small group of people to change the world, or something like that. But here's research to back that up. And to me, that is so hopeful and so powerful, and shows that it really is a thought change. It's the people who recognize the possibilities, who see a new model, even in the midst of a dysfunctional, decrepit model. You know, who are those people who are putting those solutions out there, and let's strengthen them and just repeat what they're doing and try to reach as many people with that vision of hope as possible. And then it's inevitable change. And thank goodness, because as a planet, we need that change to be happening sooner rather than later.
Yes, that's that's been my premise for several years now, or more than several years. I remember standing on the corner of Dana Drive in Cypress on the morning of the 21st of March in 2003, and there was a reporter there, and she asked another good friend, Doug Milhouse, who was standing there with me protesting the invasion of Iraq. And the reporter said, well, what about the terrorists? And I said, we're creating them right now. And so I'm not a prophet. I just can see the obvious. I had a close friend said one time, said, you have a firm grasp on the obvious. So I took it as almost an insult at the time, then realized later on that that was a compliment. So, but I and the media, of course, has failed us. That's another reason so many of us in this community helped create this radio station, is because we're not hearing voices like yours. We're not hearing the peace activists. We're not hearing the people all over the world screaming out, we have to take care of climate change. Those messages are really not getting to the public, and which is a failure. But that brings up part of the resistance to your idea is, you know, GMO corn in Iowa. That's an easy one because big money wanted that to happen, right? So, yeah, we have GMO corn now. But big money doesn't want peace and freedom around the world. Big money wants profits and power. And until we understand our collective part in that, until enough people maybe turn off the Super Bowl and go read a good book or an article by Janessa Gans Wilder, then they're not going to get a better understanding. And this is why I tend to be a cynic. I know you and I are both working towards better things, and many other people in the community are working towards better things. But I just see the system is rigged, quite simply, to support those powers and those people. Let me take a second here one more time. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun Experiment Truth Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett, with us today, Janessa Gans Wilder, ex-CIA analyst in the Green Zone and currently founder of the Euphrates Institute, working for world peace in our community. And we're discussing her work and where we fit into all of this and what we can do in the world. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, and we've got somebody in the audience that has a question. I have a very small audience here in the studio with me. Willie McCarty's with me. So for all you others, you have to call in 337-1885, and let me get Willie's mic up here, and we'll hear what Willie has to say. Yes, Willie.
Wow. Well, Janessa, thank you for bringing this to Redding, California. I see Redding, California as one of the most powerful places in the United States. And I see that because it hasn't even been discovered yet. And it's on the crosshairs of Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen, two very powerful mountains in America. And your sitting by the Euphrates brings to mind my sitting by the Sacramento River, one of the more powerful rivers in the United States, clean and pure, coming off of Mount Shasta and flowing all the way down through into San Francisco, this beautiful city on the bay. And you're brilliant for doing it here. I know that I grew up here also, and the Sacramento River was the Sacramento River. It was this really one word that described this. I thought everybody had a great river running through their yard. And so yeah. Thank you for doing this. And I think you are – this is – I'm sure that many have asked you, why do you do it in a Redding? Why don't you do it in someplace important? This is a really important place to do it. And I compliment you on it and say to you, you were right. This is the place to do it.
You know, I just thank you so much for bringing that up. Just last night, I was telling my husband, you know, look, Redding is this mountain community. It's small. It's beautiful. There's fresh air. It's like Ojai in Southern California that has all these incredible institutes and huge thought leaders and, you know, seismic things happening in this tiny mountain community in Ojai. And I'm like, Redding could be that. I just, you know, we just sort of need an infusion of, and we're trying to build it. People are bringing arts and culture and inspiration and spirituality, but all those things, it just needs, you know, that to build upon itself. And I'm with you about, I got married by the Sacramento River, and there's something about river running through a landscape, bringing that fresh inspiration, connecting us. And, you know, later I realized that the Euphrates River throughout time has been this connector between East and West civilizations. And, you know, rivers just play incredibly important features in our landscape and in our lives. They bring life, you know, water, life-giving water. And it's just so, so critical. So I think that I moved back here for family, but it's so, there is a reason that Redding is growing, and we hope that that dynamism is increasing, and we can all be part of that.
Well, with the help of Doug Bennett and KKRN and people like you coming back to Redding, coming back to seeing this place. When I moved back here, I moved back for family, but I realized I saw it with different eyes. I saw it with eyes that had seen the rest of the world and recognized that all of a sudden, when I went down and touched the river, I didn't go, ooh, it's really dirty. I went, oh my goodness, this is really beautiful. And I think mm-hmm. I think that I know that you seen the Euphrates, that story, you didn't go, I'd really like to swim in this water. It wasn't. And the Redding is an inviting place to have mm-hmm. an open heart, to be more loving. So thank you so much for doing Absolutely. What you're doing. I support you, and I'd love to help you.
Thank you. Wow, thank you so much.
Send money, Willie. Send money. Send money. Donate to the Euphrates, euphrates.org. Yeah, well, coming back to some of the ideas, I think it's some great ideas, and I think people would before we end the show. We still have another 5 minutes, but before we end the show, maybe you can give some contact information for the local chapter, because that's where people really get involved at a local level and with real mm-hmm. people instead of us just talking about it here on the radio. I'd like you to maybe give us that information. And of course, Euphrates.org is your website. Some great information there. You have an interesting staff and people that provide real insight into a lot of things. How did you build up your organization? How did it get to the point where it is now? Because it's pretty sophisticated.
Yes, we just have so much going on, whether it's bringing speakers or leading trips or publishing 3 blogs a week and newsletters and a lot of media and just really trying to spread the word out as much as possible. And you know, like KKRN, we're entirely individual donor funded, and we're just such a, you know, we are a drop of water in this huge ocean of information, but we are trying to cut through with this, with the importance of being informed, inspired, and transformed. So this chapter's idea has just been so phenomenal in anchoring us in communities and having, you know, people, as they learn more, as they go on a trip, you want to make a difference. You want to put it into practice. You want to do something. And that's when you realize how important these issues are. You don't want to just twiddle your thumbs. And it's so inspiring to see the impact that it's having in each community, as each chapter is really taking on activities that interest them and learning more and being part of the community. So the local Reading chapter, I believe you just email reading@euphrates.org. is how you connect with the chapter leaders, and or you can go on the website, and each chapter has a web page, and you can see the profile of the Reading web page, and I think the email is listed on there as well. And we have an events calendar of the different events that are going on. So I know, I think it's February 20th is when they're visiting the mosque and chatting with the imam, and then going to eat Middle Eastern food as a group afterwards. And anyone's welcome to all of these events. They also are going to be hosting several speakers who you should have on the show, by the way, Doug. There's a Tunisian exchange student right now, Fedi Laswat, I believe is his name, and he was 12 in Tunisia when, you know, Tunisia is where the Arab Spring started.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was 12, as all this was happening, and he talks about his experience in Tunisia at that time, what started the Arab Spring, where is it going, and you know, Tunisia won the Nobel Peace Prize the quartet won it last year, and they're still carrying forth that model of change, whereas Egypt has gone back to military dictatorship, and, you know, in Syria, the horribly sad story there. But Tunisia has really been a model of where it has somewhat worked. So he's wanting to speak about his experiences, and then there's a Palestinian exchange student who just gave a presentation a month or so ago at Shasta College, and she'll be doing another one. So there are lots of things happening that we would love people to become more informed about and engaged and come to the meetings or come to the events. And that's a really great way to do that right here in Reading, is to be in touch with the chapter.
Well, send me that information. I have had some people actually in Hebron, Palestinian Refugee Center there on, and I do delve into what's going on in the Middle East pretty regularly. Lately, I've been focusing on climate change, but I think it's an important message because we understand the root cause of some of the problems there. And so thanks a lot for all your great work there. We've got 1 minute left before you're going to hear some music come on. Do you have any final words or anything else you'd like to add in this last minute?
Yeah, just one thing on climate change. We're also involved. There's a Whole Earth Festival, April 23rd. Which a lot of different local organizations are being part of, and that's in front of Reading City Hall, I believe, a whole day. And as Euphrates, it's so important to be at the forefront of the climate change issue because of our dependence on fossil fuels on the Middle East and the region, and, you know, the alliance with Saudi Arabia, which is so pernicious, and that's because of oil. And so I think this reducing our dependence and our use of fossil fuels is also tied into this Middle East issue and why it's so important to be understanding and an advocate for the climate change. So I'm with you on that, too. I'll have to tune into your show when it's on climate change. That's so key.
I've had so many in the past. Lots of good stuff there if you look in the archives. And KKRN
Wonderful.
Is also a co-sponsor of the Whole Earth Watershed Festival.
Oh, so excellent.
And I was actually on the board that created it. But
perfect.
enough about me. Anyway, but that music you hear is our musical cue to say goodbye and to thank you. I want to thank you, Janessa Gans Wilder, for being on Unspun, an experiment in truth telling today.
Thank you, Doug. This was great.
Okay.
Hope to be back again.
You will be. Thank
Have
you.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, you've been listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. We have had the pleasure of having for our guest today Janessa Ganz-Wilder, ex-CIA analyst and currently founder of the Euphrates Institute, working for world peace and cultural understanding in the Middle East. I will provide links and other information along with the archives of this show at kkrn.org/shows/unspun. Next week on Unspun, we'll be talking with Tim Garrett, professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah. He has a unique view on our civilizations and our chances of surviving in the face of global warming. We're living inside the great exothermal engine, so give that some thought. Tune in next Saturday, February 13th, 9 a.m. on KKRN 88.5 FM. Next up, Peace Talks Radio.